and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Brent Palmer, the design lead at Zendesk and a lot of former great companies, and we're going to talk about data-driven design. This episode is brought to you by Tiny Reminder, a simple productivity tool for freelancers and consultants. Need content or files on time? Tiny Reminder will play bad cop for you with friendly notifications. Works great for collecting content, feedback, files, bios, or anything else. What's best, this tool is forever free. Sign up today at tinyreminder.com. Hi, Brent.
Hi, Jane.
Thank you for making it today.
Sure, happy to be here.
Fantastic. We're going to start with a short questionnaire so we can learn about yourself. And the first question is, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, so I'm a product design lead here at Zendesk. And product designer can mean all kinds of things here. User experience research also means visual design, means interaction design, means product thinking. But I support the data analytics products here in the Montpellier office in France.
Oh, fantastic. How large is your team? Are you managing other people?
Just two right now. I have a product designer underneath me, and I work with an engineering team of about 18 people.
Wow, that's great. How did you get there to where you are today? I see some famous names there, PayPal and others.
Yeah, so my background is actually in advertising. I started out in copywriting, actually, doing jingles. Yeah, writing headlines, doing jingles. Then moved to art direction. Went back in the earlier career, I think it was websites. Then things kind of switched to iPad apps, mobile apps, things like that. Interaction became more developed, starting solving more complex problems between the technology side and the design side. These two worlds kind of fit together quite nicely, called user experience, which was kind of a burgeoning industry at the time. Decided to jump ship and leave the advertising side altogether and work for PayPal. So at that point, that was kind of my kind of seminal point in my career where I decided that I didn't want to do marketing advertising anymore. I wanted to leave that behind and then get into technology. So PayPal was my first foray into doing user experience full time.
Great. I can't help myself but ask a question. Does your background as a copywriting person, I mean, that's where you started, affect the decisions that you take in design these days?
Yeah, I think so. Part of one of the many disciplines I think designers, well, product designers or user experience designers or whatever title you want to insert there is important is content and content strategy. I think that's a skill set and a piece of, that's a discipline for a designer. Well, that's a discipline that a designer needs to have command of, at least a cursory knowledge of. It's one of many layers on top of producing great design. And at Zendesk, I think how that comes to play is, we have product designers and marketing and brand creatives in the same organization. So we all report to the chief creative officer. It's more of a broader creative team. Mm-hmm. And so brand and product design live together. And so there's a lot of overlap in things that we do. And particularly here at Zendesk, where our products kind of have a more friendly, human, straightforward tone. It's not MailChimp, but there's quite a deal of personality in the products and the brand that Zendesk creates. So what we try to do is look for opportunities where these things can overlap. So if the areas where onboarding is important, areas like trial and signups, areas like product welcome messages, and when objects are shared, there's a particular tone of voice I think that's really important that kind of permeates throughout the products. So having at least a cursory knowledge, even though I don't particularly write final production ready copy anymore, being able to work with the writers on the brand side is really important.
I absolutely second that. The recommendation to study copy and the art of it is my number one thing for all designers. So I'm glad that you are absolutely the master of it.
Well, I think it's, at Zendesk, we have this interesting kind of tone of voice and interesting personality, right? Like we have this tagline, relationships are complicated, in kind of this intersection of what customers do, our customers do, and then what our customers' customers do and what they say and how they think. And so the human quality has to exist in all aspects of the business, and product just being one of them. And so hopefully the work that we do on the brand and the product design side works its way down to a lot of the stuff, a lot of the service points and touch points that customers interact with. So from sales calls, scripts, to brand guidelines, to marketing, all these things are important and a huge piece of the Zendesk brand.
How does your typical day look like?
Yeah, sure. So things are pretty chaotic here in my house. So I usually wake up to the alarm clocks for my daughters. They get them ready for school. We ship them off. I'm an expatriate here living in France. So it usually starts with a podcast, a French podcast or a French lesson, a quick one over breakfast and a cup of coffee. Try to study at least one word a day, try to incorporate that into my vocabulary here, because I hop on the train and get to work, and it's pretty much French in the office. So there are some sales reps that speak English. It's an international side of the house on that floor, but here in the engineering and product side, it's mostly French.
That question I'm going to ask now probably sounds silly, but is Zendesk an originally French product? So everything is based there?
So the data and analytics products Explore is based in Montpellier. This is one of seven products at Zendesk, and soon to be more. Headquarters is based in San Francisco. So Zendesk is a U.S. company based in SF. We have offices in Singapore. We have a product in Dublin. We have a product in Copenhagen.
Wow.
We have a product in Melbourne too. So we've got we have products and offices around the world.
Fantastic. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work process?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I love the most is the ability to kind of get on the ground floor of the rebrand and the redesign that's happening across all the Zendesk products. This is a great chance to kind of rethink and reimagine how we do customer relationships, how we develop and deliver a product that helps customer support agents around the world. We're delivering a really unique message and product to people. It's exciting to do that. It's great to be part of a French team here. I mean, not going to lie, living and working in South of France is pretty great. we've got an excellent team here. And, you know, we acquired a local startup here in Montpellier called Bime in October 2016. And since then, we've, you know, imported a few Zendesk people here. We've hired up and we staffed up and really enjoyed working with the local startup here as we go from a Bime era to a new chapter called Zendesk.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one of my future questions was that I prepared for you was that ongoing redesign. Let's touch on that later. What is your personally next big thing?
Next big thing. Well, Jane, I feel like the next thing here is to promote a design community here in Montpellier. It's not exactly the largest design community in France. So my hope is that through Zendesk and kind of a bigger Bay Area tech company name here in France, working alongside the successful startups here in Montpellier, we can really kind of coalesce a design community and do more things like meetups and, you know, dribble meetups or community events here in town that can kind of create and support each other and design talent here locally.
Absolutely. I think we skipped on the least enjoyable part about your work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the least enjoyable part is, you know, that's the thing, too. Being an expatriate, living and working in another country that's not your native tongue, hiring and conducting business in a country that's something you're unfamiliar with, you feel stupid a lot. And you have to – the putting yourself out there and taking risks and just making a fool of yourself to speak French or – knowing that you're an immigrant here and conducting business or maybe acting a certain way that's uniquely American, just the growing pains and transition of being an expat here, it's been pretty fun. but also challenging.
I believe so. It's a double-edged sword. It's at the same time great to live there, and at the same time you're experiencing that adjustment process.
Yeah. I think that we talk about diversity a lot in the Bay and what that means, different perspectives, nationalities, genders, languages, things like that. Being an American in France has really changed my perspective on that. it's one thing to kind of sit in a room and talk about diversity with a bunch of, you could be a junior or mid-level designer from an art school in America, and it's really hard to discuss diversity when you haven't really been outside your own kind of ecosystem or community. Living here has really broadened my perspective on what it means to design and create interactions for the world. Zendesk is a global product, and being able to think kind of globally instead of just U.S. focused in our design thinking has been helpful for me, just as my personal growth.
Fantastic. That totally resonates with me because I'm not a native speaker, and throughout my history, I had a number of interesting moments. One commitment I could make is that not only being myself clear to others, but when you are trying to comprehend someone and you're not able to, my big commitment is if you don't really understand something, don't say mm-hmm and like move on. Because if you don't understand something for when a person repeats like three times, like what do you do next? Do you ask the fourth time? Or do you say mm-hmm? Well, that one is a no-no.
Yeah, the more you fake it, the more humility you'll be when you're exposed. So
right. So when one of my friends say a joke that I don't understand, I just say downright, like, can you please explain that one to me?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So let's move on to data-driven design. You have exposure to a huge company with a huge customer base, and you're like one of the most qualified people to ask about it. Fantastic to thrill and thrilled to have you on board. Can you give us your personal definition of data-driven design?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for the compliment. I appreciate that. My opinion of data-driven design would be, as designers, we've seen a lot of disciplines kind of come and go, and we've grown our skill set quite a bit. And I think there's this emerging trend where designer has to be more than just kind of headphones behind a Thunderbolt display all day and kind of drawing on a moleskin pad. We're part journalist now, kind of the way we conduct our designs and how we discover and think about customers. And that kind of feedback as it comes in is data. Anecdotes, qualitative data, call it what you will, but that's a data point. And then on the flip side of that, we're also kind of building and executing queries to databases and things like that. So we have these tools that are available to us that make designs smarter and kind of inform the path. So we might, a designer now may pick up something like Mixpanel or Google Analytics or a product like Heap and run a report that may tell you the engagement of a product, right? So there's a lot of, to me, what a data-driven designer is moving out of the realm of subjectivity, where it's opinions, and moving to a level of objectivity and towards certainty.
Yeah, that sounds like a fantastic direction to go towards. What are the most significant channels of the data that you get at Zendesk, if that's right question to ask?
Yeah, sure. So we gather data in a number of ways. We use Heap here in the office here in Montpellier. That's probably one of our primary tools. That allows us to study engagement. We can kind of figure out cohorts, what people are doing in the app, when and where. The IDs and the accounts and the emails, things like that. So we also use tools like Connect, our own product, to target and market our customers. So if we see a segment that's I don't know, let's say, looking at our dashboard tab and our Analytics Product Explorer, we can find out who's doing that quickly in the last 30 days, segment them, grab their email addresses, and recruit them for a quick usability test or user testing session pretty easily. Great tool to have. We use a lot of the kind of quantitative analytics as a good starting point. And so we also use, after designs are produced, we'll get quick validation on, maybe an A or a B design with things like Usability Hub. Love them. That's a relatively new tool that we've been using where we'll put stuff online. It's great because we can gather feedback and validate designs internally throughout the broader design community and people who use data products here at Zendesk, but also externally. So anonymous participants who will come and provide feedback. And we have to be sensitive to the data security and design security and things like that about what we're showing the public, but it's a great way to get validated feedback quickly. Another tool we use is prototype and vision. We do unit testing. We use that. I haven't used it personally, but we have a couple designers who will mock something up and real quickly in Envision and then share that out. And that'll get us some good feedback right away too. Envision's great. We do a lot of, I guess just so I should back up, there's kind of we have a lot of tools in the toolbox, and when to deploy them, I think, is equally as important as what tools we use. Early in the process, let's say if we take a day in the life of a feature that we're building, it's really important to us that we kind of have a baseline. We kind of know where we are. That's where quantitative data comes in. We'll look at Heap. We may pull an old Intercom report. We may look at Google Analytics to kind of discover and really establish, okay, if we want to change that dropdown or reposition that button and move it over here, is that going to violate a lot? We use this expression in Zendesk called move the cheese. So are you going to move my cheese around all over the screen? And if so, will that be a problem? So we don't want to break anything that's working. We want to know what we're dealing with before we get into solving a problem with design. So there's that. And then we may follow up with your standard user discovery. So we might deploy, more ethnographic methods like surveys, or we may follow up. Like I said, we may isolate some people who are in our app, grab their email addresses, reach out to them quickly. And then I might schedule, a one-on-one screen share session with them, just like we're doing now. So I may use a tool called Zoom. It works really well for us. We're able to record video because most of the time I'm doing it on my own. I don't have a partner or a dedicated UX research assistant to help me with that. So I'll record my sessions, which I think is super important. That's great for us because we may get information and comments or maybe feedback about a piece of the product that's not related to what we're focusing on right now. But we want to capture that and we want to store it for later. Also helps me take really good notes because if I'm the designer working on the problem and I'm interviewing someone and they are, I'm designing the solution for them and they are the customer using the product. So it's really easy to be biased when you're giving the session and when you're receiving it. And I just want to make sure that I'm eliminating all the color and the misconceptions and the bias by recording it, setting it down, coming back to it in a few days, and approaching the notes with kind of a clear head. So we'll do that. And it's kind of a melange or kind of a group or ensemble of data points that really puts together a whole picture. And, as we kind of diverge and then converge, we might put together a design here, an A design, a B design, and then we'll use something like Usability Hub to get quick validation of that. Is this working? Are we on the right path? We have a little bit of gut and intuition that this might be the right solution, but again, we want to validate it. And then if we have it feature flagged or maybe it's in a beta, we can go back to those original customers we talked to and say, hey, Did this solve your problem? Is it working well? Would you provide feedback if you have any? And so that's kind of the long loop of data-driven design here at Zendesk.
But. Yeah, that's a huge cycle, I would say, for each little new feature. Do you use any specific tool to store all the data points that you get across various platforms?
Yeah, so we have all of our UX research in Confluence, which is helpful. What works well for us is it's just a place where everyone at Zendesk can go and access it. And everyone on the design team is basically an editor, so they can go in and help polish the notes if need be. We've got a lot of stuff in Google Drive as well. That's kind of the long tail. Anyone who's ever interested in all that decks and recordings and notes and stuff like that, they can knock themselves out and enjoy recalling through all of that. But, this part of what happens when we push a feature out is also communicating it. So, to make it more palatable and easier and more social, I guess, socialize these findings, we've done everything from, we'll put a quick little 30-second snippet from maybe one of the user testing sessions on Slack. So we'll actually post real recordings of people using the product on Slack. And we may put something like that in an email, like a roundup. The most interesting, I guess, if you would call it, the way we've gone about socializing the results is we've kind of gone analog. So we've taken things off Slack and off Drive and things like that and kind of put them around the office, put them where people are actually co-locating. So, we have a newsletter that's pasted up on the back of the bathroom stalls. So we have your uninvited attention.
right. Fantastic.
And, so we'll put some customer quotes up on there and coffee machine and refrigerator and things like that. So we get bombarded with a lot of product messaging during the day. And so we're trying to go analog and kind of go against the grain on that.
Between all the feedback that you get, do you differentiate who is this feedback coming from? For example, is this customer your best paying customer or someone using, I don't know exactly, do you have a free version or like the lowest plan? Do you differentiate between that or are all customers created equal for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer to that is no, not all feedback is created equal for us. There are many factors that go into that. Probably one of the major ones, probably one of the bigger factors is monthly spend and MRR. We also look at number of how big their account is. So we may look at agent size and how many agents they have on staff. So if we want to examine or maybe revisit an onboarding flow, let's say, then we'll look at the customers who are new to Zendesk, right? New signups, people who are on maybe a light plan that may be investigating an upgrade to a larger plan like Enterprise or Pro, right? So we'll go in there, we'll look at recent signups from the past 60 days. Those people, that's the kind of window for us where that feedback is the freshest. They haven't developed bad habits yet, where they haven't hacked, I guess, workarounds in the product UX as it exists. They're looking at the Explorer or the others in this product with fresh eyes, and they're kind of in that sweet spot where they can give us high quality feedback.
Mm-hmm. I guess the answer is all kinds of users can give valuable feedback, but you do classify it.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the problem we're trying to solve. If it's more discovery, like if we want to know if this feature or that feature, which one we should build first and prioritize it, or if it's more about, what's the best design for this problem that we're trying to solve, then we take a more broader approach and we're looking at not just people who are, masters of the product. I kind of equate it to like a ski slope, right? So if we want to look at how we do one of our core features of the product, like sharing a dashboard within your organization, well, I probably want to talk to to customers who can ski the double blacks, who are experts, but I also want to talk to customers who can ski the reds and the blues, mm-hmm. and some who can ski the greens too, because they all have to encounter that part of that user experience at some point.
For each feature that you develop from the cycle and the loop that you shared, I get that you always test at least two versions of any new feature design. So you're not trying to be opinionated and just designing one solution to a single problem.
Yeah, we try to. It depends on the scope of the design solution, but we'll always. I mean, it's just super iterative, regardless. So whether that's multiple different design options or solutions for even a minor design feature, we may share those iterations internally, right? So we may whittle it down from 4 or 5 to 2, and then at that point we may socialize it broader to either an internal team, or we may put something on Usability Hub, which may kind of, as we kind of get more data and we validate it, it becomes more clear that this is probably the stronger solution. And if it doesn't, we have the ability to A/B test or multivariate, like one version and another version. Mm-hmm. So in the past, we try to avoid it because it's expensive to build two versions. But in the past, we have been able to push out two versions of a design, broaden the sample size and the sample set, and then we get more information about which one is performing better.
Sounds like a great approach. Talking about numbers, could you share some idea how large your user base is, and for example, if you're testing something, what's the sample size, etc.?
Sure. So Zendesk, I'm not sure if I can comment on that, but for the Explore product here, we have 600-700 customers. Mm-hmm. And a typical, I usually go by, if I wanted to validate something with a one-on-one conversation, I usually adhere to the Nielsen kind of perspective, which is you don't really need more than 10. Any more than like 9 or 10 interviews will probably give you the same results. So if we have, a new design features or a feature that's coming out, that's about the maximum number of people I might set up a phone call with.
Mm-hmm. If you're interviewing, setting up an interview in 10 people and then reviewing it in feedback loops with your, with other people, that might stretch somehow in time. So are you developing a few features simultaneously always, or is it like one by one approach?
Yeah, so we have to kind of surf in between different products and features at the same time. So here in Montpellier, we may have a couple of broader epics in flight, kind of broader stories that have several different components and stories to it. Mm-hmm. So any given day, we may be working on 2 or 3 or 4 epics, which have a backlog of stuff and stories on their own. To answer your question, yeah, we overlap in our customer feedback sessions a little bit. We may come back to the same group of people to ask them about a feature or not. We have the privilege right now of being in beta with Explore, so that really helps us out. So part of the kind of agreement is the ability to approach them with some degree of frequency, and the participants who are in this program are kind of on the understanding, like, hey, it's a free product for now, with the understanding that, this is a great time and a great opportunity for us to get to know feedback about the product and for us to kind of help you high touch with how you can maximize your experience with the product as well. So there's a lot of communication back and forth during this early access program, which is good. I like it because it means they're quick to respond with feedback about the product, which is great.
Mm-hmm. Could you? So I'm going to ask two practical questions. One, could you give us a brief overview? Well, we kind of touched on that already, of tools that you're using in terms of analytics. You mentioned Mixpanel, Heap, Google Analytics. I know a lot of founders are absolutely scared to approach analytics for their products. Maybe you could give like a brief introduction what tool they should choose for that.
Yeah, sure. Oh, gosh. Well, I'll tell you the ones I like and kind of why I use them. Like I said, I use Inspectlet. It runs on apps and websites. It is great at giving me heat maps. So I can, you know, it'll record sessions and how people move around your application and your website. So I really like that to kind of give me a sense of time spent on particular pieces and interactions in the interface. I use Usability Hub, like I said, really kind of in love with that. Just pick that up. That helps me kind of quickly get validation within, you know, minutes. So being able to kind of, it's not going to give you the intent or the emotional driver, but if you have like an A/B, if you're kind of split down the middle of which design might be, you know, performing better, it's a good way to kind of get the high performer and put it into the ticket. So like, the kind of an optometrist stress is what I use that for. It's like A, you like this one, you like B, so they can both. Heap is probably our biggest and most adopted application at Zendesk. It's really great for querying data very specifically. So, you know, any kind of table, or you can slice and dice and get a report. And we use that across all of our products. So the entire Zendesk product suite shares an account of Heap. In the past, I've used Pendo. Pendo at Trendkite was pretty interesting. It helped us kind of bridge that gap between knowing which customers are engaged in our product, but then it also kind of worked like Intercom in a way where I could quickly message them or pull their email addresses out and kind of reach out to them for some quick feedback. And yeah, in the past I've used Intercom as well too. So we used Intercom at Trendkite in my previous job. And again, super great tool. Love what they're doing. Being able to quickly segment users and filter them and then reach out to them quickly as a recruitment tool, Intercom is great.
Fantastic. Another question is, since you do a lot of customer development and talk to people in person, what are your personal techniques of making that interview brief, objective, you know, without all these biases and everything, and also to the point?
Yeah, great question. So I think probably the biggest objection, or I guess not objection, but I guess the biggest concern that we have going into these sessions is if they're a vocal customer and if they've already made a lot of noise about a particular part of the product, or the tendency is to, well, we handle those kind of one of two ways, and I think I'm answering your question is like sometimes they'll want to just provide all this feedback up front, right? Like, and the trick is to kind of help. You know, I'm trying to keep them focused, so we may preemptively say, you know, I'm Brent from Zendesk. We'd love to get your feedback on the entire product experience, but can we reserve those questions to the end? So just kind of sets the expectation up front. Like, I do want to. You can give me all the feedback you want, but I really want to address something specifically in the limited amount of time we have. Or, you know, if they've been customers for quite some time, we may just pick up the phone and document. You know, they may just have a list already, and they just email it to us. And then we might read that and then call them, set up a time where we call them and we walk through it.
Provided you do so many activities, you get, for example, session recordings from Inspectlet. You get interview recordings from your interviews. Does anyone spend like a lot of time rewatching them, or you know, doing transcripts or summing them up in tables or something like that? Because that's a huge amount of work.
Yeah, you know, it's part of. I mean, up until we, well, I'm sorry, Jane. Until we kind of fully. I'm not trying to do this. I guess until the research department starts to expand and grow here, it's really kind of part of the product designer's workflow. Mm-hmm. conducting it and getting quick validation, but also socializing it. So you're right, kind of breaking down the stories into something that, like, for each audience, it's quite a bit of work. But I think that's why we've gone away from traditional channels like email and Slack and putting together a massive deck and really just kind of going analog. So, you know, a quick 10, 15 second, almost like a Snapchat that we could share, or putting a newsletter or a poster in the break room or in the bathroom stall, something like that.
Right. Yeah, the bathroom stall story is fantastic. It's really cool. I cannot avoid but ask you about the latest redesign. And I don't know how long you've been with Dendesk, but that looks like a major rebrand and might be major product redesign from the external perspective. So what is it like from the internal look?
Yeah, you know, the rebrand was quite a significant project in the works. And, you know, honestly, you know, it's the handiwork of Bob Gamari, Ryan Donahue, Toka, Aaron Pinkley. Those guys really slaved away at putting together a really great product set and UI for us. It took a lot of work getting rid of the Buddha, from what I understand. That's a pretty iconic figure. But they did a lot of work on the brand side. And I would say that one of the successes of the rebrand has been the collaboration with the product side. And I think that's one of the unique benefits, particularly during a rebrand like this. Like, you know, they explored colors and buttons and interactions and product logos and animations. It wasn't just about let's redo a logo and get rid of Buddha and place it with, you know, triangles and squares and stuff. It was actually working with the product to make sure this would fit. Because in a lot of ways, we believe that the product is the brand.
Absolutely is. Could you share like a quick story behind your new design? Because it's clearly very interesting, intricate, and geometric to the point, as opposed to the Buddha and the logo that you had before.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, one of the broadly, more conceptually, you know, I think it harkens back to the Danish roots of the founders and this idea of, like, you know, toys and these old toys that were built that kind of were meant to endure yet super simple. And I'm really glad to be part of a team that kind of looks at legacy and history and how that can inform a design language. I think that's really important.
So did the product change much besides the facelift and the recolor kind of thing? Because I'm not a user, so it's hard to judge, but I my guess is that it did.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think it's changed quite a bit. I mean, we inherited or acquired a product. And from a branding perspective, it's close, but it needs some work. So we've tried to integrate a lot of we've tried to include the rebrand effort that's happening across all the products and apply that specifically to the Explore product here in Montpellier. So take a screenshot of the product now, and if you fast forward a year, you know, in February 2018, and you took a screenshot, I think we'll find that it looks quite different.
Mm-hmm. So it's more about two different things. One is a rebrand, and second is your continuous ongoing design improvement process.
Yeah, I mean, the brand side, kind of jealous of them because sometimes they have the luxury of just making something without a lot of dependencies, right? So mm-hmm. if you want to make a banner or an email, it's pretty easy to – it's kind of self-contained. There's not a lot of stakeholders, and you're able to kind of complete that thing pretty quickly, right? Whereas if you want to rebrand one product, get alone seven – oh my gosh, I mean, what a daunting effort. And it's not like all the engineers just stop what they're doing and say, okay, we're going to spend the next 3 months redoing an interface, right? And so our strategy has been to do things incrementally and update interactions and interface like colors and buttons, things like that, as we're in the code. You know, the challenge for us here is because we have an entire suite of products and a family of products, is keeping those in sync and making sure that the latest UI pattern that we're pulling from, if we have a interaction or something like that that we're pulling from our garden library, that we're using those across all of our products, making sure that those things are in step with one another. That's really, really hard. And that's more the responsibility of the designers than it is the products and engineering teams.
Yes, that was one of my other questions that I had prepared. I know companies like yours do struggle with keeping things consistent, brand-wise and UI pattern-wise. What do you use to, what maybe special tools or special techniques or concepts are used to manage that library of things?
Yeah, so we have a UI pattern library called Garden. And mm-hmm. Jonathan Zimple and Nicolette Robichaud work on that.
And I'm sorry for interrupting. Is that in a tool that you're using, or is it something of your own that you named Garden?
Yeah, it's Zendesk's proprietary, I believe. And so we've something we've built from, I think, from the ground up. You know, it's evolving. We are still contributing to it as we continue to kind of. It's the other thing that's interesting about a redesign for all your product families. So you discover interactions and patterns that weren't there before, things that you need consistency and continuity on that you don't have a pattern for. And so, in a lot of ways, it's kind of a two-way conversation. So we'll, you know, as we build and develop our garden, our UI pattern library, and they work with products. Like products will also send that feedback towards garden. Like, hey, garden, we need a new calendar interaction pattern, for example. Can we possibly get that worked on? So, I think all the cool kids are using React now. I think that's what it's based on. But the goal is to, you know, well, if we were to dream up a perfect world, the goal is to have a centralized place and do all the things the UI library should do, which is, you know, we make one tweak to CSS, and then a button is changed across all 7 products. So kind of one ring to rule them all.
Yeah, sounds great. I think it's based on Zen Garden, isn't that? Since you're a Zendesk.
Yeah. I'm happy to share that with you. I believe it's public facing.
I will include the link in the show notes. That's going to be great for all users to have a look at it. And one last question. As you're, you know, working on the product, do you think in like percent or something like that, how much of that is actually UX and how much of that is visual style? Do you take much care of visual style? Is that another department's pain?
Yeah. So the UI component library and stuff that the garden team is doing is pretty heavily visual. A lot of the visual design direction is a tight collaboration between brand and product design. That said, you know, Zendesk puts a premium on the look and feel. It's the design team. It's really awesome. And they put really, really good work together. And I think there's a premium on visual design here at Zendesk, which I'm really drawn to. At the end of the day, you know, it's got to deliver. The designs have to deliver on core principles, which is, you know, it's got to be genuine, it has to be warm, it has to be engaging, it's got to be honest and transparent. So all these kind of brand values that we have got to be in every little pixel we do in the product.
Awesome. Really awesome. Before we wrap up today's episode, could you give our listeners some advice? So one thing they should do with data and data-driven design, and one mistake they should avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're doing design and you're guessing, stop doing that. don't guess. There are way too many tools now to get data, to validate your design, to get feedback quickly. That's out of just the realm of designers talking amongst each other and offering opinions. But there's really... gosh, there's many, many tools out there to pick up that are easy to learn as a designer, You don't have to be an analyst or some kind of BI expert to get in and actually kind of figure out engagement on products. So there's ways to work data into your day-to-day. Tools are getting much, much easier, and there's more of them.
And what about a mistake? Or is that guessing?
Yeah. I guess the mistake would be careful. I guess be careful when you share insights with the broader team. I think there can be some sensitivities to that. So if you have an engineering team that worked really hard on something, and you know, I've always believed that a designer should be about discovering the truth, right? User experience researcher and designer should be about discovering the truth and conveying it, and it really should be impartial. So I would say be careful. Sometimes the audience will take something out of context and run with it to kind of support their own narrative. And you know, that's really not anything that a designer can do about that. It's just be aware. I think that sometimes feedback and data, it's supposed to get to the truth, but like with anything, the more evidence you have, the more compelled you are to believe. And honestly, the more data you get, sometimes you can take something out of context and make your own narrative out of that. So I would just warn other designers to tell the whole truth.
Right. Not make it political by pulling it out of the context.
Exactly.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your insight today. It's definitely, definitely very important for all designers listening to us and founders as well. Could you share a place where people can find you and your work online besides Zendesk.com?
Sure. So you can find me on Medium at Brent Palmer, Twitter at Brent Palmer. I have some blog postings on brentpalmer.me as well. And if you should happen to be in Scotland at the end of March, I'll be speaking at Design It, Build It Conference 2017. If you happen to be in Copenhagen at the end of September, I'll be speaking at Design Matters 2017 then.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope your product efforts absolutely blossom at Zendesk.
Thank you, Jane. So happy to be part of this podcast.
Fantastic. Have a great day.
You too.